We are a legitimate scientific research organization whose charter just happens to be studying paranormal phenomena or ghosts. When I first started to see a lot of the paranormal shows coming out on TV, my first thought was, you know, this is really awesome. This could only be a positive thing. But, and you started to see more and more groups start. You'd have a group start, you know, in one town, and then two groups, and then three groups, and then pretty soon you have 10 groups. A lot of these groups will say that we'll get rid of whatever it is that's bothering you for $50 or $100. That's wrong. That is completely off base. So if there's a group that charges for that, you know, run. Still would love to know who initially proposed the idea that EMFs have any correlation to ghosts. There's not been any research, there's no studies that have been shown to any satisfaction that ghosts or paranormal phenomena produce EMF energy.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 3. It is February 9th, 2008, and this week we're going to go in a whole different direction here for the program. We're going to delve into an area of esoterica that we haven't really even looked at yet, and that is the ghost genre, mainly the ghost hunting genre, that has exploded on the paranormal scene over the last couple of years. We're going to finally be digging into this subject this week with our guest, Larry Flaxman, founder of the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, RPAST. Throughout this lengthy interview, we're going to be covering a number of different facets to the ghost hunting phenomenon. First, we're going to look at, of course, the ins and outs, creation and evolution and research methods of Larry's group. Plus, we're going to look at some of the staples of ghost hunting, like EMF meters, EVPs, orbs, and just the whole group mentality of the ghost hunting scene. I was very impressed with Larry's take on a lot of these subjects and very surprised by his point of view on some of this stuff. In addition to all that, yes, we do some big picture discussion on the ghost hunting field, the ghost hunting fad, the amazing explosion in popularity for ghost hunting, and the pluses and the minuses of that rapid growth. It's a lot of new terrain for BOA Audio, but rest assured we maintain our usual flavor for in-depth esoteric discussion. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Larry Flaxman, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Larry Flaxman is the founder and president of the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, known as RPAST. He has been actively involved in paranormal research and investigation for over 10 years and melds his technical, scientific, and investigative backgrounds together for no-nonsense, scientifically objective explanations regarding a variety of anomalous phenomena. He's appeared in numerous newspaper, magazine, radio, and television interviews and has authored several published articles regarding science and the paranormal. Larry also serves as technical advisor to several paranormal investigation groups throughout the country. His website is www.arpast.org, ARPAST.org. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on January 15th, 2008. Larry Flaxman, founder of the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, talking about ghost hunting on BOA Audio Season 3. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. Our guest this week is Larry Flaxman. He is the founder of RPAST, which is the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team. And he's going to tell us all about what that organization is all about. We had some emails from folks who wanted us to do some EVP-type guests, and instead of just going the route of bringing somebody on, you know, listening to the EVP and then the both of us talking about what we thought we heard, I wanted to really talk to someone who's out there in the field, doing the research, gathering those EVPs, and gathering the other evidence that other people don't seem to know about, and really get to the bottom of this ghost hunting sort of situation that's really taken the esoteric world by storm. We don't do a lot of ghost hunting stuff here on the show, but like I said, I want to get somebody who's serious about this and also isn't just jumping on the bandwagon, if you will, for studying the paranormal just because it's now popular all of a sudden via basic cable. He also comes via a strong recommendation from previous VOA audio guest Marie Jones, who I have just the utmost respect for. So when she sent me Larry's name, I checked out his website and I knew he'd be perfect for Banal of America Audio. So, Larry, welcome to the show, and it's great to have you here.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Let's start out, I guess, with the bio, the background. Who is Larry Flaxman? How did you get interested in the paranormal? And what inspired you, really, to sort of search out the answers to these mysteries?
Gosh, that's several questions in one. Let's see. I've been interested in, I guess you would say, unexplained phenomena, probably more so than specifically paranormal, for about 12 years. Like pretty much anybody else, the search for unknown is really something that has always interested me. As I've gotten older, the past couple of years, I've started to realize my own mortality. As part of that, I've sort of shifted my focus a little bit and wanted to concentrate a little bit more on the paranormal side of the unknown phenomena. So I guess that's really kind of why I started our past, looking for answers. I really wanted to do a lot of things that a lot of the other organizations that were out there are not doing. I searched and searched and searched. I was part of other organizations, learned quite a bit, but there just was not the scientific focus that I really wanted. My background is scientific. It's a combination scientific and investigative. So the methodology of our past is basically founded around that we are a 100% science-based organization. We are not ghost hunters. We actively tell people, you know, we are not ghost hunters. We do not do the things that you see some of the other groups claiming to do. We are a legitimate scientific research organization whose charter just happens to be studying paranormal phenomena or ghosts. What we generally do is we look at fundamental environmental conditions that we believe change when a paranormal event occurs. So there are certain things that we've been able to identify that change slightly in the environment, either immediately preceding or right after a paranormal event, and that's basically what we do, is we look at environmental changes. We use state-of-the-art equipment. We have approximately $250,000 worth of equipment that we use. We have a custom-built relational database where we will enter the data captured into and look for cross-correlative patterns among the data from the different investigations that we do. So what we really do is we are if you really wanted to distill it down, we're an environmental monitoring group.
But you do focus like on you know, people that say they have ghosts in their house or there's haunted places,
yeah,
type of thing.
Yeah, that primarily is our focus. We probably do between 4 to 6 investigations a month. We are a member of the TAPS family. We are booked out now with investigations from people contacting us, already booked out through April 2008, and that's with at least 2 investigations a month. Some months we actually have 4. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we stay really, really busy. You know, there are several other ghost hunting, I guess you would say, groups in Arkansas. But really, from a legitimacy standpoint, people are contacting us because they're looking for scientific answers, much more so than, you know, new age spiritual type answers.
Absolutely.
And that's what we provide.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, you know, I go down to the store and I trip over a ghost hunting group, it seems, nowadays. They're everywhere. Well, how many people do you have in the organization, and sort of talk about the evolution? Obviously, you talked about how it started because you really wanted to fill that niche that you didn't think was being looked at as far
right.
as ghost research groups. We won't call
right.
you a ghost hunter. So I guess just talk about the evolution of our past, because just based on my own experience of sort of like starting a website, starting a think tank, you know, it starts out small, but then I'm looking at your website, ourpast.org, ourpast.org, and you've got quite a few members there. You've got quite a crew there.
We do. We currently have approximately 150 members. There are quite a few members that are outside of our home state of Arkansas. We have members from all over the United States as well as international as well. So we've really kind of expanded outside the U.S. Borders as well. Actually February will be our 1 year anniversary. As I mentioned previously, there was another organization, that I was affiliated with that we had a little bit of a falling out or a disagreement, about the direction of the organization. So I decided to start RPAST. When I did that, 28 members from that previous organization left to follow me. So that was kind of the genesis of RPAST. Is we started from a previous group. We really wanted to focus more on the scientific aspect. The other organization was starting to focus a lot more on the spiritual side of things, and we really wanted to kind of shy from that and move specifically to science. We have consultants that we work with now from all over the U.S., actually all over the country or all over the world as well. We've got one in Singapore. We've got a consultant in California, New York. We work with doctors, physicists, people that are considered the best of the best in the industry. We are trying to align ourselves with legitimate scientific research. Mm-hmm. We really want to talk to and hold lines of communication with people that are outside of the ghost hunting niche, I guess you would say, people that are within the standard disciplines of science, physicists, people that are in electrical engineering, anything that could be useful as possible explanatory causes for some of the phenomena that we study.
And to sort of jump in on what you said there, when you reach out to these sort of highly respected, you know, professional mm-hmm. industry type folks, are they usually people that come to you, or do you guys find them? And what's the reaction like when you tell them about what you do and what you're looking for and that kind of thing? Because I'm sure it varies.
It does. It varies widely. With some of the shows that are out there, as you had mentioned, there's, you know, ghost hunters on every corner now, it seems like. There's also the same thing with the TV shows. There's, you know, a half a dozen TV shows at any one time that are paranormal-based programming. So there really is a wide exposure to that, to the public knowledge base. So a lot of these individuals are their first exposure to paranormal research is really from watching the TV shows. You know, they're watching Ghost Hunters. They're watching Paranormal State. They're watching some of the stuff that's out there. And, you know, a lot of the people are interested in what they see. A lot of the people, you know, watch that and they think, oh, this is just a bunch of garbage. It really depends. We've had polar opposite reactions from individuals about when we've approached them for some research help. But I think once they start looking through our website and they start seeing the legitimacy of us, we're an actual nonprofit organization. We filed for 501c3. We're going after an NSF, National Science Foundation grant. You know, once they actually see the legitimacy of the organization, I think, you know, they take a step back and say, you know, this isn't what we're seeing on TV. This is an actual scientific group. So they're a lot more positive in that respect and wanting to get involved. So, you know, really all of the people that we've contacted, we haven't had any problem with, you know, other than maybe the initial, what do you want me, you know, helping you for?
Yeah.
But once we get beyond that and they actually see what their purpose within the group would be or what they would be able to contribute, it's been great.
Now, you said you have all these members and stuff. When someone comes and wants to be a member, you know, chances are they've seen the stuff on TV.
Right.
And, you know, they want to be a part of it.
Right.
And, you know, it's sometimes hard to separate the wheat from the chaff, the serious people from the people who are just in it for thrills and giggles.
Yep.
How do you sort of deal with that sort of thing? How do you weed out the loons from the people that actually you really want to have working with you?
Right. Well, we are actually very selective about membership. We currently have closed off membership just due to that very reason. Mm-hmm. Of course, during, you know, our most popular time of the year is usually around Halloween. That's, you know, we start doing a lot more radio and TV and, you know, people start getting more interested, but then, you know, they sign up and then never to be seen again. Those are the people kind of like what you're talking about that just kind of sign up just for the thrill of it. Or there may be some individuals that will go on an investigation and they'll see that the 99% of the investigation is pretty boring. It's just sitting around and it's not anything like what you see on TV, and they decide, hey, this isn't for me. I don't want to do it. A lot of the people, like I just mentioned, they weed themselves out. That's, you know, they decide it's just not for them. It's not what they want to do. people don't want to commit to the training regimen that we have. They just don't want to put in the time. They don't want to put in the effort to actually learn how to use scientific methodology and use the equipment that we use. There's a bunch of reasons. Other than the people weeding themselves out, that's how we kind of keep ourselves controlled.
Yeah. Chances are, if they're not getting the thrill from it, you're just not going to hear from them again.
Somebody's really interested and they're really want to be a contributing member of the team, you know that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, the people that put forth the effort and the people that actually, go the distance, they make themselves known pretty early in the relationship.
And talk about the training aspect of our past, because I was really impressed with that. I'm a huge skeptic of ghost hunting groups in general. So,
right.
That's really not my bag in and of itself. I'm more of a UFO, Bigfoot guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I dabble in all genres, so I'm interested in all of them.
Sure.
But I'm very down on ghost hunting just because of the nature of the field as it is today.
So unprofessional. There's no standardization. If you look at all the groups that are out there, there is no standard method of data collection. There's no standard method of training. There's really, when you look at from one group to another, there's such a disparity in equipment that's even found. You've got some groups that have professional equipment, some groups that have consumer level equipment, some groups that have no equipment. And the same thing can be said of training. There are some groups that have absolutely no training. There are some groups that, they watch what they see on TV and they think that that's how you use an EMF meter. They think that's how you properly collect EVP without looking at, all of the pieces that should be involved in that, like the control aspect of scientific methodology. So, yeah, there is such a great disparity among it that, yeah, I can totally understand why a lot of people would think that.
So talk about your training at our past, because like I said, I was really impressed with that, and that's one of the things that made me, when I got your name from Marie, I was like, oh, no, a ghost hunter. And then it was kind of like how you described, the electricians and all the other people, then I looked at the website and I was like, oh, wait a minute, these guys are for real, they're not.
Right. Well, training is an integral part of our past. It's very, very important, and it is actually it's basic to our mission. There is so much that an individual really needs to learn before they can be an effective investigator. There's scientific basics, physics basics, electrical basics, things that people that don't have any type of a science background really need to know if they want to be productive members of the group. So to that end, training is a very, very integral part of our organization. We currently conduct two training sessions a month. We generally have one training session which is conducted at our monthly meeting. Another training session is generally conducted a couple of weeks later. But our training covers, we have a specific curriculum that we've put together. It covers everything from how to use specific pieces of equipment to how to interpret data to, basics of some scientific tenets. So people that don't have a science background can come to the organization. As long as you're open-minded, as long as you have pretty good reasoning skills, they can come to our past and we'll show them the basics of how to be a scientist. That's really what it is, the basics of how to be a scientist. We start out, we have, like I had mentioned, a very specific curriculum. We start out with fairly basic and then kind of move up from there. We have taught everything, possible that kind of falls within the paranormal realm, things that are not completely explainable, things that may be applicable to what we're doing. And I think it really helps to create a more rounded individual. Rather than watching some of the people on TV, the way they use the equipment, I don't know if you've ever watched one specific show, and I won't say the name.
Oh, maybe I don't know the show.
Well, yeah, you probably have. But one of my pet peeves is they walk around carrying an EMF meter and just swinging it around, looking for signs of a high electromagnetic field. That's a complete no-no. That's something that's like EMF 101. You learn not to do that. Not only does the human body produce microcurrents of electricity, which might be picked up by you swinging the meter around, but there's something called meter deflection as well. So as you're moving the meter around, if it's an analog meter, especially like a tri-field meter, you're going to get a little bit of meter deflection just from the movement of your hand itself. So that's all stuff that, you know, we teach. We show people how to effectively set up controls. How do we set up our experiments on investigations? How do we do equipment teardown and set up? All that stuff we teach. So I don't want my investigators going into an investigation with me and, you know, standing around not knowing what to do. I want everybody cross-trained on all of our equipment, so each one of our investigators can pick up if another person's out. They know how to use the thermal camera. They know how to use the EMF meter. They know how to use the magnetometer. So it's basically, that's basically it. It's just, it's a very, very important part of what we do. I mean, it's a nonstop, constantly evolving part of our group.
Nice, nice. See, that's what we need. We need more of that. I guess let's dive into, like, your typical investigation. How does that sort of thing evolve? Just before we even sort of get into the actual on-site investigation, how do you even determine, almost as the same situation as when you bring in a new member, how do you determine if the person calling you with a haunted location is, you know, crazy, or
right,
if their screen door is just loose, or who knows what's going on? Start with, I guess, how you separate the wheat from the chaff in the initial stage of the investigation, and then take us to the on-site investigation and what you do there.
Okay. You would actually be surprised at the amount of crackpots that contact us. I mean, we have some very unusual individuals that have contacted us wanting to come investigate. It never ceases to amaze me. But anyways, how do we kind of weed that out?
Yeah.
Well, the initial thing is the individuals will generally make contact through to us through our website. We have an investigation request form. That generally is kind of the first step. The investigation request form asks a lot of questions. There's a lot of things in there that may be kind of disqualifiers for us moving to stage two for the investigation. So that kind of helps. We'll read through the investigation request, or if it's someplace that we're contacting, obviously that's going to be a little bit different, but we'll read through the investigation request. We'll kind of do a little bit of research on the location. If we can find anything about it, we'll pull assessor's records on the property. We'll see if there's any interesting history of the property, anything that may be a possible trigger point for whatever activity is there before we decide to go out and investigate it or not. If it makes it beyond that, you know, beyond the initial evaluation, then we generally set up a phone or in-person interview where we'll kind of get the lay of the land by speaking to the homeowner, either going there in person, which I generally like because I can read a lot from body language and just kind of get the full picture in 30 seconds just from talking to someone. So that's pretty important. If we cannot do that, we'll do a phone interview, kind of get our bearings from that, see if that's a legitimate sounding investigation. If some of the events that they're reporting are things that, you know, are pretty typical from other investigations that people have reported, or if it's, you know, some things that are pretty far out there. Once we've decided that, you know, yes or no, we have a basic flow chart that we follow for that. But once we've decided yes or no on the investigation, then our case manager will then contact the individual to look at some possible dates where we can come out and do an investigation, give them a couple of different options as far as what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We generally try to schedule them on Saturdays, Saturday evenings. Most of our people have full-time jobs, so it's, you know, unfortunately this doesn't pay the bills. So we have to kind of work around it on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up the investigation. Once that's done, then Tiffany Pressler and myself, the vice president, will designate the team structure of how many people are going to attend. That'll be based on the size of the location that we're going to, as well as the suspected activity. We'll set up a team structure. Again, it'll generally be, well, really depending on the size, but we'll do, you know, three teams of two teams of three. It just really depends.
Yeah.
Our tech manager he always goes. Our case manager always goes. Tiffany always goes, and I always go. Beyond that, the other individuals in the organization, we go on a rotational basis, so that's how we're able to be fair to all the people that are in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned before, everybody is cross-trained, so whether I pick one person from Team A, one person from Team B, everyone knows how to use the same equipment. Everyone's been through the same training.
Yeah.
That's basically the first part of it.
Okay.
We actually have the date. We go out there. We show up on scene. get a quick little tour, and I'm kind of distilling this whole process down. But
that's fine.
Go out, show up on scene. We'll take we'll draw a map of the location first. We'll take baseline readings of the location. We generally have about 15 different data points that we capture for our initial baseline readings. We'll go. We'll set up cameras. We'll set up some of the experiments that we wanted to do. And that's pretty much it. That's setting up the investigation and getting it going. Once the investigation actually starts, the teams split off after the equipment's been deployed. The teams will split off to do the experiments, to do EVP recordings, to kind of do things on their own little in their own little groups. Mm-hmm. They'll rotate out after 30, 45 minutes, check another location, and that goes on pretty much throughout the night. We generally set up a standard command post where the DVR system is, laptops, all the monitoring equipment that we use is situated. And that's pretty much it. It's the night is generally pretty boring for the most part. We just sit around. I like to say that most of our investigations are hours and hours of boredom punctuated by sheer terror. So, you know, we may have just a few moments of, you know, things going on, but for the most part, it's not what you see on TV. You know, TV really paints a brilliant picture of an investigation. You know, if you watch the shows, they show the equipment setup taking, you know, all of 5 minutes, where really that's not the case. It generally takes an hour and a half to 2 hours to deploy all the cameras and run the cabling and make sure everything is set up the way it's supposed to be set up. Then they don't show you on TV how long it takes to tear all the stuff down. What all they do is they pretty much show you when things happen. And
yeah,
that's pretty rare. And that's really few and far between. For the most part, you know, none of the magic happens until afterwards. When you get back home and you actually sit down and dedicate the time to go back through the data and start reviewing all the evidence that you have. So, of course, you know, if there actually was a reality show about it, about ghost hunting, and they actually followed us around and did an investigation with us, it probably wouldn't sell advertising because it's so boring.
That's the nature of television, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, you say when you go on site, you the people go out and they do these experiments. What
right.
Give me an example of what the what an experiment would be, because when I think of the ghost hunting that I've seen on TV, you know, it seems like they're just running around with a tape recorder or an EMF
right.
meter. They're not really doing any experiments. So
right.
Talk about what you guys do for experiments.
Okay. Yeah, again, that's, you know, that's stark contrast to scientific methodology and how we actually prefer to conduct our investigations. Experiment-wise, we will do different investigations dependent on the symptoms, I guess you would say, of the investigation or of the reported symptoms. We'll set up trigger objects. We did an investigation on Friday. Last Friday, it was at a museum northern part of the state. There was a report that there was a one of the trophies that had moved. So one of the experiments that we did was we set up a piece of paper basically with grid points on it, and the trophy was on top of that with flour all around it. So if it actually would have moved, we would have actually seen some minor tracks or whatever in there. We'll do experiments like that. If we're doing an investigation where it's reported that there's a child that's been present or that's been seen, we'll set up little toy cars and let them be watched or monitored by the video cameras. Stuff like that. We'll set up the Tesla coil. We'll do some experiments with that. Just various things. I mean, it really depends on the location, but we try doing controlled experiments where, you know, we're actually controlling the environment and actually trying to log data based on the controlled environment.
Yeah. You say you have like $250,000 worth of equipment, which is astounding to me because I'm just stunned by that. I think I'd be I'm still amazed by just how well my TiVo works. Talk a little bit about your equipment and that sort of thing and all the various accoutrements that go along with that.
Well, since we are not a ghost hunting group, and again, we are looking at primarily environmental conditions that are present during a paranormal event, the equipment that we have to use is basically very specialized for that. There are a variety of pieces of equipment that we use that are not even store-bought pieces. They're actually custom-designed pieces. the off-the-shelf equipment that you can buy, a lot of the thermometers, a lot of the EMF meters, stuff like that, most groups get, there's not any control over the tolerances. That's the word I'm looking for, the tolerances. So you really don't have any type of a base comparison. You can't take a piece of equipment, know that it's calibrated, know that, you know, that this is what it's supposed to read, and then be able to compare it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, they just go out there, rip it out of the package, and think that, you know, because it's going off the chart, that they've got something good, but they don't realize that really, you know, they didn't white balance it, if you will. That's kind of the best way to put it.
Right. And a lot of the consumer stuff does not even have that ability. I mean, you can't even balance the equipment like what you just mentioned. I mean, it's just turn it on and go. There's not any type of actual calibration that's required. So a lot of the higher-end equipment that we use, actually, there is. There is actually calibration that's required. There's actually tolerances that are very specific and very strict. And that's all, you know, as far as being able to present us with good data, good clean data, that stuff's what's required. And, you know, you pay a premium for that, just like anything else. You know, you're paying for the name, you're also paying for the quality of the item. There's half a dozen thermal camera manufacturers that are out there, but, you know, the best in the industry is FLIR, and that's what we use. So, you know, same methodology, I guess you could say, for that. You know, we may use a lot of the same equipment that other groups do. Most of it is different, but, you know, some of it is the same that other groups use. But it's the high-end versions of EMF meters, the high-end versions of digital recorders. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
And it's expensive. I mean, you pay for that, honestly.
Yeah, and I presume, much like any other paranormal research group or an anomalous research group, the funds to pay for that sort of thing probably comes out of your pocket, right?
No, not just mine.
The membership, yeah.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, we're going through the process for an NSF, National Science Foundation grant. We are looking, hopefully, to get a large grant from them to continue our research. But, yeah, for the most part now, we are completely member and user funded.
I guess, you kind of already touched on this, but maybe just expand a little bit more, because I found this to be fascinating, and it completely enlightens me to something that I see on TV all the time. And you really sort of debunk the whole idea of the EMF meter as like the ghost detector, even though somewhere along the way it seems to have been misconstrued that that's the case.
Right.
I guess just talk a little bit more here about the EMF meter and how, you know, some people, when you see them on TV running around with it, they're not even using it right. And,
correct.
And, you know, it's just not all it's cracked up to be. You shouldn't just, you know, let some clown in your house with an EMF reader and take their word
right.
for it if they say it's haunted.
Well, you know, I'd still would love to know who initially proposed the idea that EMFs have any correlation to ghosts. You know, I'd really like to know how that came about in the first place. The majority of time what we use EMF detectors for are detecting large amounts of ungrounded energy. Basically, we're an unshielded breaker box. That's a huge amount of, you know, debunks that we've been able to do is, you know, we've used the EMF meter to determine that they've got a breaker box, it's unshielded, it's spitting out high levels of EMF in the environment, and it's probably causing some brain issue. I don't know where that came from, where all of a sudden some TV persona just decided that, you know, an EMF meter is what you use to detect a ghost. There's not been any research, there's no studies that have been shown to any satisfaction that ghosts or paranormal phenomena produce EMF energy. So, yeah, that's kind of a sore point for me, too. I mean, people see that on TV and they think that that's, you know, that's kind of like the main tool that we use, and it's really not. It's kind of just an adjunct piece of equipment. It's definitely not one of the prime pieces of equipment that we use.
Yeah. I think you also pointed out earlier in the interview and on the website that if someone's just, like, walking around with the EMF meter, they're not even using it right.
No, correct. Yeah, most of the equipment, you know, again, it kind of speaks to where you had gone with the training. Most of the groups that are out there and most of the paranormal investigations that are conducted, there is no training. The equipment that they use, you know, they've not gone through any kind of a certification process. They've not gone through any type of formal corporation training, you know, formal corporate training. You know, same thermal imager. Okay, there's several groups that are out there besides ours that have thermal imagers. How many other groups actually have gone through FLIR thermography training besides me? Don't know. I haven't seen any other groups that have shown any preponderance to the training aspect of that. You know, that's such, you know, you probably, we don't want to get into probably the details on that, but that specific piece of equipment is so complicated and it's so easy to misinterpret that unless you actually have some formalized training in thermography and actually know what you're looking at, it's so easy to misconstrue the results. And it's the same thing basically with any piece of equipment. You know, somebody that's not familiar with what a normal reading for an EMF meter is versus an elevated reading, it's the exact same thing. The data that they're getting is invalid. They're not getting clean data.
Yeah.
So training really is a very, very important aspect of this entire field, and I really wish that more paranormal groups would take that seriously, because that's, you know, one of the reasons why we have such bad reputations, the whole paranormal field, is probably due to that very reason. People will watch the TV shows. They'll see how the equipment's not being used properly. They'll see how the methodology of the investigation actually flows, and they'll think these people are not seriously, you know, doing this properly. They're not serious about the commitment to doing this. If they're really looking for answers, they would be doing things the proper way, or they would at least make an attempt to do things the proper way.
Yeah. At the risk of, you know, telling tales out of school, have you contacted these the people, you know, who we see on TV that aren't using the equipment properly, that are making – you know, these illogical leaps based on faulty use of their stuff? Have you contacted these people and been like, hey, you know, you're not doing this right, and you're setting a terrible example for all the amateur people that want to get into the field? Has there been any dialogue between you and the people who seem to be setting this false standard out there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, an important thing to remember is it's not just the TV shows. It's other groups that are out there too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, once you get the ball rolling and it starts rolling downhill, it just kind of picks up speed and picks up speed. So, yeah, we've attempted to do that with some of the shows that are on TV as well as some other organizations. You know, sometimes we've been met with positive results, sometimes not. You know, there's a lot of groups that, you know, we'll look at our offer and they'll think, well, you know, that's just not the way we want to do it. You know, we don't want to be a 100% science-based organization. You know, different groups really have different purposes. And I've kind of come to understand that more and more as I've done this. You know, I really was very down on the whole spiritual aspect of paranormal investigation. And, you know, as I'm doing this more, you know, I'm starting to realize that those groups have a purpose too. You know, our group has a purpose. There's a specific thing that we want, and that's science. Other groups have kind of, you know, they have a different focus, and that's okay. They may not want to follow the scientific side of things as well, and it doesn't make either one of our groups right or wrong. It's just different. So, you know, just because they don't necessarily look for answers in the same way that we do, or they don't think the same way that we do, doesn't mean that, you know, they're making a mistake or we're making a mistake. It's just different.
Yeah. And what about the people that are just using the equipment wrong, like we talked about? Have you been like, hey, dude, you're not even using the EMF meter right?
Right.
You know, do they get back to you and say, you know, oh, I didn't realize that? Or are they like, it's just entertainment?
The ones that we've pointed out, we do a lot of collaborations with other paranormal groups.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've done some of our collaborative investigations, we've pointed out, you know, some opportunities for education to them. And, you know, they've been, oh, that's great. Nobody ever told us this before. We didn't know that that's the way you're supposed to do it. Or, you know, they what they're seeing on TV is not indicative necessarily of the way it really should be.
Yeah.
So by kind of pointing that out, yeah, we've actually had really good results with that. You know, people have said, you know, this is great. I really wish I would have known this before.
Well, let's talk about the other crown jewel, I guess you could say, of ghost hunting. And I'm only using that as the catch-all term. I apologize. I know you're not a ghost hunter, but, you know, we're speaking to a general audience here, so we'll try and keep it simple for them. And that is, of course, the EVP, which is so enormously popular over the last 5 years or so. It's just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
I guess let's start with sort of your take on EVPs, because I'm sure that your group collects a fair amount of audio from the sites you visit and stuff like that, and you've got great stuff, I'm sure, and you've got some bizarre stuff. So
yep.
Give me your take on EVPs and all that sort of weirdness.
I'm a huge proponent of EVP. I think EVP, to me, it really represents one of the best forms of evidence that we've been able to capture. There are very specific signature. There is a very specific signature that we've been able to identify in the vast majority of Class A or easily discernible vocal utterances. We do a lot of EVP capture as well. That's a huge part of what we do. So yeah, we do. You're absolutely right. We have quite a bit of good stuff. We have quite a bit of bad stuff and quite a bit of, you know, possible weird stuff. But yeah, it's good. It's important.
On the website, you have a really awesome classification system for the EVPs, and something that, you know, I never really thought of. I have two classifications for EVPs, maybe real and not, probably not real. That's
right.
My classification system. And maybe a third that's just like crappy or what, you know,
yeah.
Like where'd you get that?
Sure.
But you have actually like a serious EVP classification system that I really appreciated. So talk about that system you guys have at the website.
Well, you know, I think having a standard process or a standard classification system is really important, especially just due to the fact that other groups really are not following the same methodologies as we are as far as capturing EVP. So, you know, there's some groups that will use digital recorders, some groups that use analog recorders. So by having the kind of having a standardized method of that, of classifying things, it allows us to kind of bridge the gap between different organizations. So our classification system, we've got DC, which is direct communication, and that's basically that the voice clearly answers a question or responds to something which is said. That's pretty rare. I'd say we don't really have that that line of communication very often, but it definitely has happened. PC is a personal communication, where the voice says something that's meaningfully directed at a specific person that's present. There's a random communication, which is RC, which is a disembodied voice that really answers no direct question. It doesn't appear to be aimed at a particular person, and it really doesn't make any sense in any context whatsoever. That's kind of the specialized categories. And then, of course, there's Class A, which is clear, very easy to discern. It sounds basically just like normal speech. Class B is kind of a lower volume. The voice generally can sound warped, but you can still kind of make it out, especially if you're using closed-ear headphones. Class C is generally the crappy EVPs. You generally cannot understand what they're saying. They're not clear whatsoever. Most of the Class Cs that we get, we just discard.
Yeah.
And they're not even worth anything as far as scientific validity. There's different categories. We've got an event-related voice, a morphing voice, a thread-related voice. There's a chorale-related voice. You know, the more ways that we can use to classify the sounds, the better information that we have for our database as well.
Yeah. All right. As far as like you have them broken down here, direct communication, personal communication, random communication. Have you noticed any sort of trends as far as that goes? Like, you know, you go to one place and it's always DC.
No, that's really interesting. We've run some of our correlative queries among some of the locations that we've investigated, and no, there is absolutely no relationship. And that's actually a very interesting question that you asked that. No, there is not, and that's something that we're trying to determine why. There is no pattern that's significantly statistical among the locations. So no, there is not.
And I presume the process with the EVPs is the same as I've been led to believe, which is, you know, you get back from the site and then you listen to them and then you sort of, you know, then you're like, oh, wait a minute, rewind, let me hear that part again type of
right.
thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. There is a very specific signature that we look for EVPs, which really kind of helps us to weed out a lot of the chafe. There is a very specific spectral dynamic that we look at. So that really does kind of make our job easier. But, yeah, that it's, you know, hours and hours and hours of reviewing audio. I mean, there's really no way around that, but, yeah.
I'm sure. And I guess, like, you kind of touched on this with the classification system, but just what do you think of the sort of explosion of EVPs in the last, like, few years? It seems like, you know, it's kind of run away from itself in a way. It started out pretty novel, but now it's almost, you know, overdone.
Yeah, it really is. you know, again, if you watch the TV shows, a lot of times you'll see they're not really capturing EVP maybe in the most proper manner. A lot of the individuals will use a digital recorder or they'll use an analog recorder with no external microphone. So, you know, what that's going to do is you're going to pick up noise basically from the internal mechanism of the unit itself. So electrical devices act as radio receivers as well. One of the theories that we have about some EVPs is that what you're actually hearing is radio fragments or broadcast fragments, whether it's an analog cell phone, whether it's AM, FM, whether it's one of the other banded radio type stations that are out there. You know, there's a possibility that that's what you're getting is actual audio broadcast segments. So yeah, there's, you know, within the last couple of years, there has really been an explosion of electronic voice phenomena captured. But, you know, at the same time, there's also been a greatly increased number of audio transmissions that, you know, mankind has sent out into the atmosphere. So, you know, are we picking up something legitimate? Or are we picking up, you know, just fragments of man? I'm not positive. I don't know exactly. But yeah.
Is the sort of thing, like you say, you look for the specific signatures, is that the sort of thing you can only really know from actually looking at the audio on the computer when
yes.
it's splayed
yeah.
out for you? It's
yeah.
not something you can just tell from listening.
No, generally not. There's a subsonic frequency or subsonic signature that's present on the vast majority of legitimate EVPs. We call it an impulse pop, and basically it's an impulse event that occurs immediately preceding the EVP. So it's not something that you generally hear, but if you're looking at the spectral display of it, it's something that's very easy to discern.
Hmm. Interesting. One other area of ghost hunting that you're not a fan of, it seems, from the website, is the orbs trend.
No.
You had a number of pieces at the RPAS website where
right.
you pretty much tear apart the orbs.
Yeah.
Situation. Let's talk about orbs and why you're not a fan of orbs as ghostly evidence, if you will.
Okay. There are, you know, as you know, there are several schools of thought regarding the orb phenomena. Our position as a research organization is that the orb phenomena is simply nothing more than airborne particulate matter, i.e. dust. One of the pieces of equipment that we use, that we deploy on our investigations, is a very high-end particle counter. And basically what we'll do is we'll go into a location, we'll use the particle counter to determine the size and the frequency of airborne dust, pieces of junk floating around in the air. And what we found is that almost without exception, almost 100% of the time, that the locations that have high amounts of particulate matter in the air. Now, of course, this isn't something that you generally can see. You may be in the most clean room that you could possibly think of, and there's still going to be a significant amount of airborne material that's present. But with the particle counter, we've been able to show that the locations that have reported more orb activity are generally those that have very large, very high concentrations of particulate matter that's present. So from the scientific aspect, it's totally debunked. You know, that's pretty much a home run on that one. The flip side of that is, as I had mentioned before, there are a lot of, you know, different groups, I think, have different purposes. Again, ours is more of a scientific nature, but there are groups that are out there that are very much pro-orb. And, you know, by doing that, they're basically, you've probably seen the people on the websites talking about, you know, I can tell this is my grandmother looking over me, you know, she follows me around the house, that kind of stuff. You know, that's okay. If they're using this as a coping mechanism and it helps them to feel better, it helps them to maybe grieve a loss, you know, that's okay. You know, I really don't have a problem with that. You know, is it scientific? No. But is it wrong? No. You know, if that's what they want to believe and they're, you know, if it really helps them to cope with something, you know, far be it from us to tell them that it's dust.
Yeah, but it's not exactly a good idea if they're going to like a third party location and they're like taking a bunch of pictures and then they're like, Mr. Smith, your
right.
house is absolutely haunted because there's orbs all over these pictures.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, we don't
no.
want that.
That actually, that is a piece of equipment that I wish more groups would utilize. I think if they had the budget for it and they utilized that, I think a lot of other groups would actually see the error of their ways with orbs.
When you go to a site and you do the investigation and then you come back and you dig through all the stuff, do you come out with like a final sort of report situation? And what do you tell the people?
We do.
What do you tell, like, what's in the final report, if you will, and what do you tell the people that you went to their house and investigated or went to their location and investigated?
Well, a vast majority of the investigations that we do, we've been able to show just scientific basis for why they're experiencing the phenomena that they are. Generally, it's not something paranormal. There's generally a very benign explanation, whether it's, you know, an electrical appliance maybe that's emitting high EMFs, a water heater that's not grounded, a gas line maybe that's leaking. There's generally an underlying environmental condition that's kind of prescient to the experience that they're having. So a lot of times the final report, if you will, is kind of like a home inspection report in what we provide to the homeowner. We're actually showing them things. A good example of that, we actually haven't released this final report yet. We did an investigation last Saturday where we found what appears to be, and we're going to actually have to follow up on this, but we found what appears to be a large concentration of carbon dioxide that's based underneath the house. This individual has... They've had all kinds of episodes in the house of seeing things, hearing things, headaches, lots of things that are typically associated with high levels of CO2, carbon dioxide. And it just so happened that the heating and air conditioning system had recently been serviced. They had, for some reason, they had discovered that all of the ductwork underneath the place had been completely shredded. They don't know what had shredded it, but they had just recently done some service on that. So, you know, that's a natural explanation for a paranormal event. So, you know, the final report will reflect that. It will reflect some of the dangerous findings that we found. Another investigation, we found a water heater that had a line coming into the water here, the cold water line coming into the hot water heater. That basically when they either put it in or when they'd done some construction, they had grounded the cold water pipe. So, you know, there was negative charge that was flowing through the pipe. So that was another thing. So the final inspection report, I guess you would say, or the final report really is kind of a mini home inspection in that it shows a lot of underlying environmental conditions that may be possible factors in the paranormal phenomena that there occur, or what they believe to be paranormal phenomena in there. We never tell a homeowner that, yes, your location is haunted, no, your location is not haunted, simply because we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, there is absolutely no way to 100% definitively say what is haunted and what's not. You know, we can say, based on our experience, based on the environmental conditions, you know, you've got something funny that's going on here, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, you've got ghosts in your house. You've just got something strange. And, yes, we do reveal that to the owners.
Nice. And now you said the majority have, I guess you could say, prosaic explanations.
Very much so.
For the stuff. What percentage would you say would be stuff where you can't rule out, you know, where the prosaic explanations have been ruled out and you're sort of stumped, if you will, you know, the unexplainables?
Less than 1%.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, definitely less than 1%. There is just a handful of things, and I'm kind of thinking back as we're talking. There, you know, in my 12 years of doing this, I can count probably on one hand the number of things that have occurred that I can't explain scientifically. So, yeah, 99.9% of, you know, what we do, there is a prosaic or there is a very rational explanation too. But, you know, then it's the that tenth of a percent that, you know, you really can't explain.
Yeah.
That's kind of what keeps me going doing this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for that small handful of anomalous places, if you will, have you noticed any sort of, like, trends as far as those places go? You know, anything?
Nope.
No trends?
No trends. No. Again, the same thing kind of as the EVPs. It's just a very random type occurrence. One of the things that we're looking to use our database for is for determining trends, and that's exactly why we built the database, is we wanted to determine if there were any trends among locations, and we've yet to really see any concrete trends. I mean, there's really nothing that is, you know, 100% predictable yet at this point. Of course, you know, we're still doing investigations. We investigate nonstop and hoping for the Holy Grail, but yeah, it's just not there yet.
Yeah.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Why are we continuing to play this little game when we all know it has moved to the next stage?